I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, podcasts. Do we think Adam Buxton would sue me if I started using that as my opener? Probably not. He seems pretty nice, eh? Speaking of nice, we have the amazingly nice and cool and kind and hilarious Caroline O'Donoghue at the Hot Mess Clubhouse this week. If this is your first time at the Clubhouse, we are a podcast that celebrates hilarious women, and this season is all about funny writers like Caroline. I'm your often annoying but mostly good-hearted host, Lucy Vine, and I'm delighted to be here gushing about Caroline, because she is excellent. Not only did she pen one of last year's most exciting novels, Promising Young Women, she's also behind my favourite award-nominated podcast, Sentimental Garbage. We talk about her podcast work as well as her writing, but we mostly discuss nonsense stuff like proposals at funerals, first snogs and having sweaty undertits. We didn't talk about her two upcoming books, Scenes of a Graphic Nature and All Our Hidden Gifts, coming out in the next couple of years, but you should absolutely definitely buy those anyway. Okay, that's enough. Enjoy! Welcome to the Clubhouse.
Thank you. It's good to be in the Clubhouse. Yeah. Figurative Clubhouse that right
now.
No,
it's not figuratively. You are in a Clubhouse with me now.
Okay.
Anyway, how's your day been so far?
Well, I've got a raging period.
Great.
Yeah. So I'm that kind of mix between both, like, pale and red at the same time.
Oh, I get so, such bad flushes when I'm on my period.
Yeah. So yeah. You feel like there's just, like, you're just a landscape of grey with splodges of red on top and just...
So nice, isn't it?
Do you know that bit, that kind of, like, the... I'm going to call it the equator of the body. Where, right. Like, that line kind of where you fold your stomach kind of thing.
Right, yeah.
That's just a clammy line all the time.
Oh, mine is anyway, because I've got more lines there than you do.
But do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
The trunk gets very clammy.
Yeah, it's nice, isn't it? Just the undertit.
Yeah,
well.
Yeah, everywhere.
I don't
know
how much undertit. But
between
undertit,
that area, between, like, under the tit to the sort of top of the leg, all just very hot.
Sweaty.
Yeah. But also in your bones, you feel very cold.
Yeah.
But your skin is very hot. It's been a bad one.
Being a woman, isn't it?
It's been a bad one, yeah.
I've been trying to track my cycles a bit more in the last couple of years.
I'm a natural cycles now. It's very weird.
The app thing.
The app thing, the thermometer app.
So do you know what your cycle is? Do you actually...
Yeah, for the first time ever, yeah.
See, because I thought I'd finally figured it out, and I've got quite a long cycle. It's like 33 days, and I'd finally figured it out. And then this last month, it turned up on day 27, and I'm really fucked off about it.
Yeah.
Fucking trying to mess with me just because I'm like, I finally figured you out, period.
Yeah.
Now it's just doing it to mess with me.
Yeah, it's like an actor who's been doing some kind of roles for years and years. Yeah. And like, you know what? I'm going to do a character role in a children's film.
It's exactly the same.
It's exactly what it is.
What a great analogy.
It's Timothy Spall in a children's film. But I'm really happy to be here. This is the first bit of
really
official
happy.
Business I've done all day because I've been so miserable about myself.
Oh.
I just wanted to be honest, you know?
Yeah, great. Straight
that's
in
where
there.
We're at.
Oh, well, thank you so much for being here.
I'm glad to see your lovely wholesome face.
Thank you.
Yeah.
It is really wholesome.
It is.
So I'm going to start with the Clubhouse initiation.
Oh, right, okay.
Which is actually just like a quick fire get to know you round. But it also doesn't have to be quick because we're like super chilled.
And very sluggish.
Yeah, and very periody. So I'm just periody all month round. So
sure.
I'm with you there. So are you ready? What is your favourite swear word?
Oh, cunt.
Great.
Yeah.
Good choice. How old were you when you had your first tongue kiss?
Oh.
As the kids call it.
A tongue kiss. Oh, about 13.
Okay.
And I think I was the oldest of my group of mates.
Okay.
I was kind of one of the last
frigid.
Women standing, do you know what I mean? Like a frigid, yeah, exactly. Or in Ireland, we always say frigid.
Oh,
and I never
the same.
Yeah, same thing, but it's just the accent with the frigid.
Oh, okay.
I don't know why.
But it's definitely a T and not just an accent.
Definitely a T. I don't know. I never made the connection until I was much older. Frigid.
You just thought we were saying it wrong.
Yeah. Totally. But anyway, I wanted to get out of the way because I didn't want to be the last one. I think it was down to two girls, do you know what I mean? It was me or
pressure.
The other one. It's that real, you know, looking at each other from across a Western...
Yes.
So I literally just went up to somebody at a disco and just snogged them.
Oh, someone you knew?
No, just someone's name that I never knew and I never saw them again, but I just wanted to get out of the way. And I'm really sad that I sort of buckled to that pressure.
Nah, I don't think kissing's that big a deal.
Yeah.
I mean, did he put a finger or anything?
What, my ass?
Was there a finger anywhere?
No, it was just like about 10 seconds of that. And then, walked our separate directions and I never found out.
He didn't even get his name?
No.
Oh, that's sad. Was it any good?
No, of course not. Kissing doesn't get good until you're like 15 at least.
Surely, yeah.
Yeah.
I'm still waiting for it. Who is your favourite drag queen?
Oh, Jesus.
This is too difficult.
That's a huge question.
I promised you no difficult questions, but I thought that you would.
No, just because there's so many. But actually, do you know, my favourite drag queen is Candy Warhol.
Oh my God.
Who is a Cork drag queen, who is actually my drag mother.
Shut up.
Because she put me into drag last week. She's
great.
How long
did it take?
3 hours. And I'm not even padded or cinched or anything.
And you're an actual woman, so she's
an actual woman. It was for an article. I pitched an article because she is the mother of Cork's only drag family. And so I pitched an article interviewing her and her putting me into drag. And what was interesting was, I assumed that my drag personality or my drag character would be a heightened version of myself. But what it turned out to be was this whole other character.
That's
like,
so exciting.
You can see from the pictures, it's kind of
dark
like
hair.
A really ramped up Vivian Leigh in Gone with the Wind. Like,
yes.
Like black hair.
So were you
feathers.
Involved? Like, were you saying, no, I want to have this colour hair and... Or did it just turn out that way?
She emailed me beforehand being like, what kind of drag queens do you love? What kind of style do you love? And I was like, oh, I kind of like kind of grunge, but I also like kind of southern gothic and stuff. And then we ended up with this Vivian Leigh type character that we call the Countess.
Have you ever got off with someone at a funeral?
What? I mean...
Sorry. Jade's tack.
I'm sure I've been to a funeral with my boyfriend... And
okay,
then
so
kissed him later that day.
That's
maybe.
A yes. Disrespectful garbage fire.
Oh my god, I do have a story about this though.
Okay, go on then.
About 2 years ago, my boyfriend of 5 years, his grandmother died. And, you know, we went to the funeral and obviously very, very sad. Mm-hmm. And I knew that the church that we're going to is a very, very small church in Essex that you have to like cross a bridge to get to, and it's very beautiful. And I know that this church means a lot to him, and he's kind of said to me before, and he's not like a sentimental person, but he's like, oh, you know, all the men in my family have gotten married in this church and stuff. And as we were leaving the church, he was like, hey, hang back a second. And I was like, okay. And he was like, you know, my granddad's actually buried behind the church. Do you mind if we go see him? Just the two of us. And I was like, sure. And I was like, oh, fuck, is he going to propose now?
Oh, God.
Because, okay, nice if he does, I suppose, but also, like, why is he doing this now? We're going to steal the thunder from his nan, who's dead. She's going to hate me. She'll haunt me, whatever. And I was, like, running panic stations in my head. And then we just, like, went to the grave, saw the grave, and then walked back, and then I was really furious.
Did you tell him?
I did. I told him about 6 months later. Which was funny and not like, so what, you were at my nan's funeral thinking only of yourself.
Maybe I wasn't getting a proposal.
Yeah.
Outraged. What's the worst sext you've ever received or indeed sent?
Do you know what? This is very embarrassing for me, actually.
Why?
This is almost more embarrassing because it's something I've questioned a lot. It's like, I've never really sexted anyone.
It's not embarrassing.
Or no, it is because
I don't find it sexy.
No, and maybe I wouldn't either, but I just, I've obviously, been with Dan for 5 years, but before that, I was with, I had several boyfriends, I had dated
at
and
once.
Everything, and I'd generally had a pretty good experience dating, but I've never had, obviously, no one's ever thought, do you know who I'm going to send a picture of my dick to? Karen, I don't know who. And I sometimes worry I don't ignite that in men.
No, you don't date twats, basically. I think that's
maybe that's it. I mean, I have dated some twats, but maybe, I don't know, I just...
Some people really get off on it. I just find it too amusing. In fact, all sexy things I just find too amusing.
Yeah.
This is why I can never be a romance novelist. just laugh about it.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, so I wanted to ask you about your family.
Yeah.
You are Irish? That's a guess.
Do you think?
No,
I mean, I'm still trying to figure out. I've signed up to 23andMe
sure,
to find out what my ancestry is.
What that whole thing is.
But I have a hunch. So I grew up in Cork, which is a lovely city in the south of Ireland.
Yes.
It's kind of the second biggest city after Dublin. Yeah, and I'm the youngest of four kids.
Yes.
I've got my older sister Jill and two parents.
And Catholic.
Yeah, but like Catholic, my mum's been saying to me, she's like, why are you always going on about being Catholic? It's like, we weren't really religious, and we weren't, and we aren't. But there's I always find that, especially when talking to English audiences or English people in general, that like there's a secularism to British Protestantism, which I know you're Catholic as well, aren't you?
Yeah.
Yeah, that like...
Well,
they
very much lapsed.
Yeah, exactly, very
really
much lapsed. Like, I went through did you go through the three C's?
Which is...
Confession.
Oh, okay.
Confession, communion, confirmation.
Oh, yes, I did those, yes.
Yeah, all the good ones,
all the best.
All the weird trauma-inducing
Did you
things.
Find confession quite stressful? Because I was always like, how much do I actually... I know you're supposed to tell everything, but I was like, but do I tell them how angry I am with my siblings about the remote control?
I remember my first confession, I was...
Yeah.
And,
God, it's so young to be saying
so young.
Kids, you're going to go to hell, you need to go and cleanse your soul in a small room with an old man.
Like, explaining original sin to a six-year-old
is it.
And people are like, how do we explain, like, gay people or trans people to children? It's like, how do you explain original sin to a five-year-old, you know?
I made my five-year-old niece watch RuPaul's Drag Race yesterday.
Yeah.
And she went home and put it on. And my sister would just heard all these fucks from the other room, and she was like, so, and she, India, my niece, was like, oh, yeah, I watch it at Lucy's all the time.
Oh,
and I was like,
God.
Okay,
Lucy.
Watched it together one time, and you were so into it. But I think it's really important, because they're very much like, but is that a woman,
it gives them a nice, we're going far from the point, but
it's okay for everything, you know?
It's a nice... What I found this is a total segue. But,
sorry, I just asked you.
But what I love about RuPaul's Drag Race, and I know there are a lot of queens who are critical of what it's done to the kind of economy of drag,
sure.
which is interesting, and also, you know, RuPaul's personal politics aren't always great, but what is great about RuPaul's Drag Race is that because they themselves always refer to each other as she, and, like, you literally see someone like Money Exchange or Bob's Drag Queen, like, these, like, very huge, like, very masculine black men.
Bob the drag queen.
Yeah, exactly, but they're referring to each other as she all the time, and it's, like, it makes you sort of, like, break down, like, it makes you... If you're not up on, like, trans issues, and lots of people aren't, and they're kind of... People are trying to learn and get there, it's, like, it makes you appreciate how fluid these things actually are.
Absolutely, yeah.
And I think it's, like, such a great intro into that kind of...
Community.
Oh, I definitely think so, and just kind of them realising that... Because they are in such, like, a white, middle-class, straight area and world.
Yeah.
That the idea of actually seeing, you know... Because it confuses them that, men and men, or women and women. And so they need that sort of world opening up to them, I think, personally. So I'm there to confuse my nieces. Sorry. So, confession at six.
I remember it being... I was worried that the thing that I actually thought was the worst thing I'd ever done... was too bad to tell the priest.
Do you remember what it was?
Yes, it was that my neighbour had a birthday party and I got bored, so I left. And then, like, no one could find me because I was this, like, spacey kid who was always wandering around. And so no one could find me. And then my mum, like, found me basically wandering in the street, and she was like, you can't... She was, like, so freaked out. She was like, you can't do this. Like, you can't... First of all, it's rude to the host. Second of all, we had no idea where you were. And it was, like, it had been very recently... to going for my first confession, and I still felt very guilty over it because she'd been so worried, and she probably laid it on a bit thick.
Yeah,
but
she's
freaking out. And I remember thinking that, like, if I told the priest that, he would think I was the worst thing in the world. So I just said, I kicked my dog, and at that point, I didn't have a dog.
That's way worse.
So it's way worse.
What is wrong with you?
Also, I invented a dog we as of yet did not have, and I had built this, like, raft of lies that I was floating to hell on.
It's funny, isn't it? So you grew up in Ireland, and then what were you like as a teenager?
To be honest, my parents, whenever I said it, that I was kind of naughty or rebellious, they're like, no, you weren't.
See, it's probably, again, this Catholic thing where you disproportionately in your memory thought of things
maybe.
As being awful.
The difference was, my brother, who is 18 months older than me, he was a proper, like, rabble-rouser, like, got kicked out of a couple of schools, like, a proper, like, you know... bad boy or whatever, and giving my parents no end of stress. And my older brother, again, was also quite wild. So comparatively, I was just, you know, smoking weed, like cutting glass, like your standard thing. I wasn't actually causing trouble. I was just being negligent and a bit cheeky. So no one really cared. It was like, you know what? This is very low level. Like, yeah. That's just, this is fine. You
compared
know?
Compared to her brothers.
Yeah, exactly. And like, I remember someone said to me, it was actually a therapist, said, if the first thing that you ever remember hearing about yourself was how easy you are. That's the first thing I ever heard, really, was like, okay, the boys are a nightmare. My sister Jill had diabetes, which was quite, you know, hard to regulate at that time.
Yeah.
At least Caroline's easy. And I remember hearing that, and like, I feel it now.
Kind of facilitating a whole life.
Yeah, being a massive...
Everybody's okay, and being the only one that won't cause any stress.
Yeah, very bad.
To talk to other people when you are having an issue then, because you're like, I can't put my issues on other people.
Very much that. Say when I go to my boyfriend about things or whatever, or I'm like, hi, I'm feeling... like, I have depression, but don't worry, I've made an appointment at the therapist. Basically, like,
it's fine, it's fine, everything's okay, you don't need to do anything.
Yeah, but just so you know, I will be on Thursdays between 3 and 4, I will be doing this, so, like, that's it now, goodbye.
Let's never speak of this again.
Yeah.
If you see me crying in the corner, don't even talk to me. Yeah, so this is very familiar. So what happened after school then?
Luckily, university in Ireland at that time was incredibly cheap. It was, like, £1,000 a year.
We fucked that up now.
Yeah. I'm not sure what the fees are larger now, but they're not crazy. Yeah. They're like, and luckily Cork is a great city, and it does have a really good university, so I was able to live at home for most of uni.
Right. What did you study?
English.
Yeah.
Fine. I had the privilege of being able to go to these quite expensive private schools, but I was really doing really, really badly at them. Like, it was D's and C's all the time. And as well, like, these were... like, all-girls schools where it was incredibly high-achieving, and there was, like, people sort of having panic attacks all over the place. They weren't getting, like, A-stars or whatever. And there was I was barely scraping a pass, and I felt really inadequate, and I dusted off school a lot.
Well, I was going to say, did you feel like you were trying, or was it that you were like, I will never be able to do this, so I'm just not even going to try?
I think it was a mix of both. Okay. I was like, I would go through spurts of really trying, mm-hmm. and then... I felt like I had already been written off as an idiot, so I just... And also, I remember, it's actually a very, like, upsetting thing that happened, where I am really, like, knuckled down for a while. I was like, I'm gonna turn a corner, this is gonna be it. And I really swatted up for this French vocab test, and it was, like, one of those proper, like, oh, the teacher just recites some words and you write them in French kind of thing.
Right.
And then you're scored out of 20 at the end. Not, like, a big test, just, like, a weekly test. And I was about 16, and I got, like, 19 out of 20.
Wow.
And I was, like, delighted with myself. That never happened to me before. And I was so happy. And I was called up at the end of class. And the teacher told me that, like, clearly she wasn't going to mark it because I had clearly cheated.
You're kidding.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
And that day, I had my first ever panic attack.
Oh, you're kidding.
Yeah, I did. I've never talked about that, actually, since it happened, I don't think.
The way we treat kids.
Yeah.
To disillusion a child like that and to put that on a child. Oh, that's really upsetting.
I think then when I went to university, because English degrees are, like, so essay-based and just, like, here's a book, what did you think of it?
Yeah.
And I was like, what? Like, that's... like, this is my life for the next 3 years? Yeah, it's incredible. And I immediately got, like, pretty high marks. And it was, like, incredible confidence.
One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST.
That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
I suppose the plus side of being a teenager in a city like that is that it's like this lovely small city where you can kind of either walk or get the bus anywhere. And like, I was in bands and like, I just had a really great time outside of school. But I think inside of school, I just found the actual education part really hard.
Yeah, fair enough. Yeah. So then how did you end up in journalism? What happened after school?
It was like one of those things where writing was always the only thing I was good at. And my parents were super, super supportive. I remember coming home when I was 7 and being like, I got like a star on like an essay, a short story I'd written about a tree. It was called The Magic Tree. It was
Is
a magic
not
tree.
Not an Enid Blyton novel.
But I remember like from then on, because my dad was quite arty and my mom is a huge reader.
Right.
They were always very much like, and this is Caroline, and she wants to be a writer. And she wants to be. They were always like,
that's
like,
lovely.
Yeah, that's who you are now. And it was like really, really encouraged. We loved it.
So if you were like me, that sort of role in the family, I don't know about you, but I wrote a lot of things down instead of.
Yeah.
So I had like a diary, and I would write and write and write in a corner and read and write and read.
Totally.
So it's drilled into you, isn't it? Being
yeah.
In that role.
I think as well, when you're the youngest, you're the natural storyteller. Because everything interesting happened before you were born and you're all hearing about it. You know what I mean?
Yes.
Right?
I'm very aware of that.
Yeah. And also, it's that thing of like you're constantly trying to like speak up at the dinner table and everyone's talking over you, and so you end up just sort of writing things to yourself instead.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sad.
It is sad. I mean, it's just
so
what it is.
I'm so sorry for us.
I know.
So hard done by.
It's going to be really like depressing. Like,
No.
It's a theory talking, guys.
Sorry. But so then you were always writing. So you just sort of always thought you would be a writer.
Yeah, no, always did. I had a lot of confidence in that area. I remember I had a blog going. What happened was I lived with like my best mate, who's still my best mate now. We both worked in HMV, and like HMV was like the only like CD shop in like of any measurable size in the province. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
So it was like it had a weird kind of cultural cachet. It's so sad, but it was like the objectively coolest I've ever been.
HMV was amazing.
Yeah, and I worked there for 3 years, and like it was the kind of place where like, you know, the local radio station would often just drop in sort of gig tickets and stuff, and we were just out all the time. It was fabulous. And then that suddenly ended because all of my friends were a couple of years older than me, and I was living with all of them. They all either emigrated or had to get real jobs, and then I had nobody left to live with. And then I was my final year of university, and I had not made any friends in my actual classes, so I was like suddenly felt very, very alone. And then because of that, I started my blog, and that I remember that being the way that like I remember because it was early sort of Facebook, and seeing all my friends like in Australia and Canada and like England and stuff doing all this great stuff. This was my way of being like, okay, you're doing stuff, but I'm like making jokes over here, and I'm like reviewing like albums and stuff on my blog, and yeah. And I remember feeling like, okay, this is like my thing now. And then eventually I had a friend whose sister worked at the Cork News, which was the local paper, and she said, oh, do you want to, you obviously like music, do you want to review the gigs? So I used to like review gigs in exchange for free tickets. And then I was just like, oh, maybe journalism. And then eventually when that year ended, I was also keen to immigrate because at that point, you know, I hadn't made any new friends.
friendless.
Yeah, I was still friendless, but I had this blog and it was kind of all I was living for. And I was like, okay, well, I'm going to make a full-time thing of this. And I applied for the Best for Film internship, which was then run by Natasha Hodgson and the late John Underwood. And I moved there, did this internship for 6 weeks, and those people became my best friends.
Oh.
And everyone who did that internship became my best friend. And, like, the root of everyone I am close to now came out of that internship, and it was just the best thing I've done in my life.
Are you going to stay in journalism? Because you obviously have these two fantastic podcasts that...
Thank you so much. You've been on both of them. So you kind of have to.
So that's why they're brilliant, obviously. But do you want to describe them? First of all, those School for Dumb Women, and then more recently, Sentimental Garbage. Describe
sure.
them for my mum and dad who are listening.
Okay, so are they going to listen to
No,
you?
Of course they're not.
Of course
I just thought maybe there'd be two listeners.
Yes. So School for Dumb Women is a podcast I do with the comedian Alexandra Haddo and the producer Hannah Barrell. And it is basically a general knowledge comedy podcast where we like teach each other about things we've learned in a kind of a half-arsed, you know, I've read half a Wikipedia page sort of way. Like, there is some really interesting stuff on it. I've learned some great stuff, but it's mostly an excuse for the three of us to talk shit because we used to work together at the pool. And once we all stopped working at the pool, it was like, oh, we need a way to see each other. Because you know how, like, when you have friends from old jobs that you love and then you don't work there anymore. You never see them again. Or you end up just meeting up to talk about people you worked with and, like,
oh, yes,
and the conversation never gets new.
Like, oh, that editor's gone on to do that.
Yeah, and then you end up having this really, like, sad, desperate sort of like wine nights that you allegedly look forward to, and then you actually have nothing to say.
Then everybody bails.
Yeah, and they're still like my best friends, so it's great.
Well, that's amazing. And then Sentimental Garbage. Some incredible guests like me. I'm not talking to me. I mean, like, yeah. Marion Keyes and Joanne Harris and Jill Mansell. You've had some amazing people.
Yeah, I've really loved it. So Sentimental Garbage is a chick lit podcast that's just yeah, me inviting somebody on to talk about some chiclet they like. It's quite a simple concept, but the reason I did it was actually because I was rereading Rachel's Holiday,
right.
And then after that I kind of realised, I was like, God, this is amazing what Marion Keyes did with the Walsh sisters, which you and I have talked about extensively.
Yes.
I think our second episode of The Middle Garbage, and I was like, oh God, I'd love to read someone really getting into the whole Walsh sister dynamic in the way that people talk about, like, the Brontes or, like, you know, the Marches with Little Women. And I kind of looking at, like, nobody ever had. And I was like, oh, I feel really like, I feel really itchy now. I really want that content. And I was like, oh, well, I could make that content.
You could. And you did.
Yeah.
And it's absolutely amazing.
Yeah.
But I also wanted to ask you about Dumb Women. Did you ever feel afraid when you, seems a bit melodramatic to use the word afraid, but, like, you guys do talk about all of these things that women are not supposed to talk about.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, we've already talked about period, but, like, poo.
We are quite disgusting.
Do you get much shit, basically, from people?
Never.
No, really?
Never. We have never really gotten any feedback, any negative feedback for that. I mean, yeah, no, we've had people been like, I think, emailing me like, oh, you kind of got that wrong or
okay,
whatever.
Yeah. But
occasionally.
I suppose men wouldn't even listen, so they're not there to be like, let me just correct you about cystitis.
I think for the most part, we've had overwhelmingly positive responses from people about the kind of grosser stuff.
Because it's important.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah.
Okay, well, it feels important to me.
It does,
it's never really talked about. It felt, I mean, with my first book, Hot Mess, like, she talks about period poo. Like, the fact that you get kind of diarrhea when you're on your period.
You do feel very slim.
Well, that aside, it's just not something, like, it was something that I only realised. I just thought it was something that happened to me for a long time. And then eventually there was, and I kind of fought to have that mentioned in the book because I was like, people don't ever kind of, and that is the thing.
That people talk to you about.
Talk to me.
Of
like,
course
I didn't even know it was a thing. And wow, that bit sort of thing.
I had a similar-ish scene in my book where someone's having their period, but it's one of those periods where, like, it's so heavy that she's kind of being like, is this a
menstruation?
Oh, shit. Like, you know, not in the kind of a totally grim way. Just, you know how, like, everyone's had that weird abstract thought where they're like, and the thing of, like, she's, like, reaching into herself and she's pulling out kind of clots and stuff.
Yeah, I remember.
And I've had so many people talk to me about that scene, and like, she's also in a McDonald's bathroom and she's had to wind, like, the really cheap horrible tissue paper around her knickers, and she's sort of walking like the Lone Ranger, and it's like, it's quite a dark scene because she's genuinely considering whether she's miscarried, but also she's walking like the Lone Ranger. It's like, that's fucking the tragicomedy of being a woman, isn't it? Like,
oh yeah,
you have to fucking laugh about
it. But let's talk about your wonderful book then, Promising Young Women.
Oh yeah,
it's now out in paperback.
It is, and it looks, oh God.
Oh, it's so gorgeous. Do you have much say in, like...
I had none. I had no input.
Would you like to describe what it's about for
me? Yeah, it's about a girl. Her name is Jane. She works in the advertising industry, and she's kind of turning 26 on the day we meet her, and she's recently broken up with her boyfriend, and she's kind of like, meh, quarter-life crisis, things are bad. sorry, I've lived with Jane for a long time now, so I'm just, like, I'm sort of over her shit a bit.
Yeah.
No, but, so we meet her at this point in her life, and she's kind of feeling that shiftlessness of, like, having lived in London a few years, not having any really close relationships, feeling like, what am I doing? I'm at this job where, like, I'm not good at it. No one really cares what I do here, but in a bad way, you know? And then she kind of falls into this relationship with her boss, and that starts because he thinks she's incredibly talented and he kind of really supports her at work and all this stuff, and it becomes this sort of meshing of a thing of, oh, am I getting ahead at work because I'm sleeping with this guy? Am I getting ahead because I'm really good at it? Is it at both? And like kind of the anxiety of that sends her into this sort of spiral, and he kind of reveals himself to be more of a big bad bastard than he is.
Yeah. How did you come to write it?
I wrote an article about the relationship between older men and younger women, and then suddenly, you know how it is online where like you could be writing for ages and ages and years and have no one care, and then suddenly everyone cares at once. And then somebody approached me saying you should write a book, and then I was like, oh well, one person who works in the publishing industry thinks that.
Was that at Virago that you...
No, it was a totally different publisher who I ended up not going with, but it was just the fact that an editor...
Somebody had actually said it to you.
Yeah.
So and then did you go away and actually write it at that point?
Yeah, it did.
Wow,
and
like,
I got an agent, Bryony Woods, and she sort of like held my hand for the first draft, and like I sent her chapter by chapter, and she kind of corrected like homework, and it was lovely.
That's really nice. What was it like when the book came out initially in hardback? Was it last year? Only last year?
It came out in, June 2018, yes.
Yeah, so it was last year, wasn't it? Yeah.
It was, yeah.
Just the time disappeared.
It's a real funny thing. It's lovely.
Yeah.
Because this thing that's lived in your head for so long, and it really can't be overstated how long it does take. Between like you writing the actual manuscript, the various marketing machinations that have to happen, it takes really so long. What nobody tells you though is that if you're a debut author, and if any debut authors are listening to this and who are like really hopeful about their book coming out or whatever, dial back your expectations about 75%, because here's what happens. Every bookshop in the country, if they decide to order in your book, and there is no guarantee that they will order in the hardback version if you are lucky enough to get a hardback, which I was and I'm very grateful for. But because hardbacks are expensive and don't always sell well, this is important information, they don't always sell well, so they will order perhaps one or maybe two copies. So you will walk into a Waterstones waiting for the display or the pile of books, and then like you will have to look and find and eventually find maybe one copy, and then you will have to watch that one copy for several weeks. Eventually it will go, and then you will think, because that copy has been sold, more copies of the hardback will come in. It will not. They will wait for the paperback to come out, and they will base the selling of that one copy on how many bloody paperbacks they order in. And then by kind of month 7 of your hardback being out, you will begin to question whether or not you ever wrote a book at all.
Yep.
The only thing that will remind you that you ever had a book is like people occasionally tagging you on Instagram.
Right.
And that was actually the loveliest thing, because I think a lot of debut people have a lot of this problem where they have a couple of weeks when the book comes out, their publicist has been great, they're on a few panels, they have a few interviews in newspapers or whatever, and then suddenly it all ends. And then it's somebody else's sort of moment, and you have to just be graceful and have to step aside and just be like, there you go.
Do you have any negative reviews?
There were a couple.
They don't seem to affect you though.
Not really. I mean, they obviously did, of course, at the beginning they did. Everything affects you. You're so vulnerable because you've put this thing out there. But now, like, it never does, and the reviews are good, but it's lovely to watch as time goes past. It's like, oh, this isn't one of those books that people just like forget about or just like isn't slept about. Like, this is growing. Like, this is a thing that people are still passing from hand to hand, and like, that's lovely.
Do you ever get tempted to reply to any reviews? Like, I mean, negative, although you haven't really had any, so fuck you.
No, don't. I have had them. I absolutely have.
But you don't seem to be bothered by it. I got really like obsessive
really?
About it. Yeah, it was like having an ex-boyfriend on Facebook. Like, I had to eventually just sort of stop looking, because I've got lovely reviews mostly, but there are some very not nice good ones.
There are people saying, you know, it was overrated, or they didn't like the tonal shift. Because the sort of catch with my book or whatever has been kind of marketed is that like it starts off as being quite like a Bridget Jonesy thing, and then it ends up being quite gothic-y. It's kind of a bit of a body horror in there. And some people either love that or they hated it.
Yeah.
And that's like, that's one of those things where it's like, it's just an aesthetic thing that you can't control.
Yeah,
you know?
And you just have to accept that.
Yeah.
But I think I thought, because obviously been writing as a journalist for so long, I just sort of assumed that
it wouldn't affect you.
It wouldn't affect me because my journalism started it. But I think there's this weird expectation as well. When people are reviewing books, they kind of have this idea that like what you've written you think is perfect, and that you've put something out there that is, you believe, is flawless and fucking Charles Dickens or something, and therefore you need to be taken down a little bit. Like,
That is so true.
Anyway.
No, and like, I was having breakfast with my sister like 2 weeks ago, and we were talking about the book or whatever, and she sort of said, you know, and she kind of, you could tell she was really sensitive to it. She's like, you know, the ending didn't really work for me. I was like, yeah, I agree. Do you know what I mean?
It's like, I don't know any author that hasn't kind of, after it's gone to the printer, gone, oh, I want to claw it back and rewrite or take it out.
It's so weird, because like you do, for the first bit, like you see all the flaws in it and you don't see any of the great bits that you were really proud of when you wrote or that your editor loved or whatever. You just see the bits that you're like, oh, I can totally see the strings behind the puppet there, you know? And then after a while you just become very at peace with it. You're like,
sure,
that was my first book.
Yeah.
And,
so have you written the new one? The next one?
Yeah.
So what's the deal there? How much can you tell where?
Oh, well, it's, I think, I don't
everything.
Know. Yeah, they never told me not to say it.
We will now read from your manuscript.
I'd like that, actually, but, yeah, it is a murder mystery, kind of. It seems to be this is going to be the pattern with how I write, in that it begins like one kind of book and it ends like another. So the book opens and it's this 20-something, and she's living at home again because her father is dying. And it's one of those things where it's like she's really resentful because all of her friends are moving on to do really cool things. But because she's been like a carer for her dad for the last few years, her 20s haven't like kicked off.
Gotcha.
And it's a bit like, it feels very kind of like what at the beginning, like one of those sort of family dramas where we all learn something, you know? But then what happens is that a murder mystery plot is thrown in and then it kind of becomes a thriller.
Amazing.
I'm really proud of it. Yeah. I also don't think it's any good yet. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I'm proud of how hard I've worked,
until
I guess.
Until somebody outside of your friends and family tells you it's good, it's shit.
Yeah.
Do you feel like that?
A little bit. Although, what's really nice about writing your second book is that even though your anxiety is higher, I don't know if you've ever
said,
my anxiety was much, much higher about like, because
the second album.
Yeah, and especially when like, I called my book Promising Young Women, and that led to a lot of reviews that were like, even if they liked her head in the book, they're like, and it's clear from Donahue's prose style that she's a promising young voice indeed. And it was like, writing, I didn't want to like let them down on that promise.
Oh,
I didn't want to be held to ransom over this promise that I had promised them. So I was like, oh fuck, have I like shit the bed on my promise? But then what's freeing about that is that you realise, if you're working with a great group, and I'm working with Sarah Savage, who's an amazing editor, and Virago, who are an amazing team, is that they'll catch the crap.
Yeah, we'd hope
they will be the nappy on your shitty anus. They will just catch that shit, and like nothing, like nobody will let you write a bad book if they can help it, and that's a really good thing.
I suppose it is in their interest to make it
good
and successful.
Yeah.
When is the second book out? Do you have a date for that yet?
And it'll be in 2020 at some point.
Okay,
yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
But by Promising Young Women in the meantime, because it's fucking wonderful.
It's very good. Yeah.
Oh, it's very, very good.
Please ignore all that stuff I said about feeling bits of it.
Shitty ending. Yeah. Don't read the end. Just read like 75% of it. Amazing. Thank you so much for joining me today, Caroline. And thank you everyone out there for listening. Please rate and subscribe if you have a minute. Bye.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.